This is Ann Arbor Stories. And do I have a deal for you? Ann Arbor Stories will be taking our show on the road for two shows this summer, presenting tales from Ann Arbor's past in an immersive multimedia experience. Music, visuals, and my dumb voice to give you a more complete telling of some of the great stories of Ann Arbor's past. The first event is on Thursday, June 22nd at 7 p.m. at the Ann Arbor Summer Festival as part of Nerd Night. If you caught our first live performance this past winter at Nerd Night, a live telling of the history of Ann Arbor's Red Light District, we're going to do that again, but this time with fewer narrator errors. And we'll be outside, and it'll be the summertime, and it'll be great. And if you haven't seen us talk about Ann Arbor's Red Light District in person, holy moly, you're in for a treat. The music and the skeezy pictures of 1980s pornographers is well worth your time. Join us on June 22nd at the Summer Festival. Learn more at annarbor.nerdnight.com or visit a2sf.org. A band we like called Frontier Ruckus plays at 8:30, then they're showing Say Anything. You can make a whole night out of it. Our second event this summer is on Monday, July 10th at 7 p.m. at Literati Bookstore. I know, right? No pressure. We'll present two all-new live Ann Arbor stories in the cozy confines of their second-floor space, set to music and packed full of photos, video, everything. We'll follow up with a little Q&A and hopefully get a second chance to meet all of you and buy some books together. June 22nd and July 10th, resistance is futile. Now for the episode. This is Ann Arbor Stories. I'm Rich Reddy. In 1824, a pair of men walked into a tiny federal land office in Detroit and bought 640 acres of prime Michigan land for $1.25 an acre. A speculatory purchase by two Yankees looking to make their fortune in the sparsely settled Midwest. These pioneers were John Allen and Elisha Rumsey, founders of the town they quaintly named first after their wives, and second after the wild arbor they planted, so the women could relax and chat their days away. That story, like a good bit of the mythology surrounding Allen, Rumsey, and those early days in Ann Arbor, is Bull Roar. John Allen's wife didn't arrive in Ann Arbor until well after the town had its name, and in the wild, wild beginnings of Ann Arbor, there wasn't a lot of time for lounging under arbors. Just a lot of working the land and working to sell plots on those 640 prime acres in the hopes of making heaps of cash money. You want the sanitized history of the men who found Ann Arbor? Believe that malarkey about the wives eating grapes under the arbor. You want the real story? Listen to this tale of Ann Arbor's dirty, rotten founders. Elisha Walker Rumsey. You know it's going to be tough to tell someone's full story when even the year of their birth is unclear. Rumsey was born on or around 1785 in Sharon, Connecticut, and at the age of 39, give or take, found himself in that land office in Detroit signing paperwork with a man 10 years his junior who only a month earlier was a complete stranger. Laying down his life savings on a government man's desk to purchase 160 acres of land next to a river named after the natives who settled the land and a creek that would be named after his partner. Rumsey was accompanied by his new wife, Mary Ann Sprague. They met in Bethany, New York about 4 years earlier when both Elisha and Mary Ann were married to other people. No details of their courtship exist, but two things happened that helped eventually deliver Rumsey to Ann Arbor. The first was Rumsey's wife dying shortly after giving birth to their fifth child. The second was a company entrusting Rumsey with $3,000 cash to travel across the state and buy cattle on their behalf. He now had a dilemma. Sacks of cash and a chance to be with the good wife Sprague, or do the job and stay home with five motherless kids ranging from 9 years to 6 weeks in age. Dirty, rotten founder. Rumsey took the cash and the girl and bolted for Canada. The Great White North didn't really pan out, so the couple traveled south into Michigan, where the law caught up with them. Elisha and Mary Ann agreed to return to New York, where Rumsey paid back the cow money and settled the charges against him. Sprague divorced her husband and properly married Rumsey back in his hometown in Connecticut, then returned to Bethany to begin anew. That probably went well, right? Rumsey running away with another man's wife after his own beloved had died following childbirth, letting relatives in town divvy up and raise his children, stealing an amount of money 3.5 times the value of what he and John Allen would pay for Ann Arbor, then returning to the town this whole mess started to make a fresh go of it. Yeah, that didn't last long. In the fall of 1823, Rumsey sold his 117-acre farm for $2,340, paying $900 to settle the mortgage and settling a number of debts around town. That left him with a little money to make a start somewhere else. Having spent time in Michigan, Rumsey thought the territory held a lot of promise, both personally and financially. It was in Detroit that Rumsey met fellow founder John Allen. The pair had a common interest in buying promising tracts of land somewhere in the area and making horse and buggies full of dollar bills. Someone tried to get them to go in on land in Toledo, but Ohio, am I right? And they instead chose to buy up the land that would become Ann Arbor instead. The location they chose was better than most. Close to the growing city of Detroit, but not too close in case the Canadians got feisty and decided to take the city back again, see 1812 Battle of. Fertile soil, access to the Huron River and other waterways to provide sustenance and power, trees, lots and lots of trees, a functioning weather shield, this Ann Arbor of theirs had it all. They built Rumsey's house first, a log structure 1 story high, and Allen slept nearby in a tent. Rumsey and his wife were tasked with being the face of Ann Arbor for anyone who was thinking of settling there, while Allen was the marketing man, placing ads in newspapers and trying to drum up new business for affordable plots of land. The Rumseys shared their home/hotel with new arrivals, recent land purchasers, new neighbors, or those just checking things out. They added a second, slightly larger building and called it the Washtenaw Coffee House. By all accounts, the Rumseys did a great job of boarding, feeding, and showing these fine pioneer folk around. Only 2 descriptions of Rumsey the man exist today. The first describes him as, quote, a commonplace man, both in ability and appearance. That's a little harsh. The second describes him as, quote, a man of more than an ordinary intelligence, and he knew how to keep a hotel. Not a lot better, but we'll take what we can get. The combination of Allen doing the selling and the Rumseys doing the hosting worked. By the 4th of July of that first year, 50 people were living in the upper settlement of Ann Arbor. Log huts popped up on Washington and William. The coffee house bustled day and night. The town's first sawmill was built. They sold more and more land to new arrivals, and Ann Arbor spread in all directions. Then, 3 years after arriving, Elisha Rumsey died of fever. He was in his 40s, which was about the normal life expectancy back then, even for a dirty rotten founder. Maybe especially for a dirty rotten founder. He was buried in Forest Hill Cemetery beneath a headstone with the inscription, "The First Settler in Ann Arbor." Mary Ann moved away and remarried, leaving John Allen and his wife Ann as 2 of the 400 people who now called Ann Arbor home. What of the Allens, particularly John, the other dirty rotten founder of Ann Arbor? Born in Augusta County, Virginia, on May 17, 1796, John Allen came from an old family line in the Shenandoah Valley. Not quite as upper class as the Old South plantation owners, his family, quote, possessed the same pride in family and good breeding as did the most aristocratic Virginians. He grew up with all the advantages that a child of new money gets. Good schools, good food, good horses. He was described as, quote, physically a very grand specimen of a man, over 6 feet tall and well-proportioned, well-educated, not a classical scholar, but a very good English scholar, and very apt in acquiring the elements of science. He was charming, likable, a decent businessman who took decent risks, not unlike his father. He parlayed his charm and almost upper-class station into a pretty sweet nuptial arrangement. At 19, he married the wealthy heiress Mary Crawford, whose family was older and more established than his own, and owned hundreds of acres in Virginia and Kentucky. To celebrate the wedding, Allen's father gifted him 397 acres on which to begin his new life, along with additional land holdings with a grand total of $12,000. That's 15 times the amount that he paid for Ann Arbor. This 19-year-old kid was set for life. Except, 6 years later, Mary Crawford was dead, and John Allen's father was in massive debt to the tune of $40,000. John Allen sold and mortgaged everything he could to rescue his father. Then, when the money was gone, used that Allen charm to wed a second time, once again marrying up. This time to a woman who not only came from a wealthy family, but inherited her first husband's substantial fortune upon his premature death. Mrs. Anne Isabella Barry McHugh came from French nobility, attended finishing school, was deeply religious, and had zero sense of humor. John Allen was rougher around the edges, up for adventure, and looking for a fresh start because, oh yeah, his family's enormous debt. In 1823, rather than use his new wife's considerable fortune to bail his family out, he transferred the family's debt back to his father, sorry, Dad, and left Virginia, never to return. The reasons for the move are a little murky. In the tax collector's records for 1824, next to John Allen's name, the word absconded can be found. There's also a story of him buying a considerable lot of cattle on credit and agreeing to drive them to Baltimore, sell them, and repay the loan plus interest. Allen took possession of the cattle, made it to Baltimore, and did in fact sell them, though he never quite got around to paying the men in Virginia back, nor settling many of his own debts in the South. Dirty, rotten founder. Instead, with the proceeds of the cattle sale, Allen went to Buffalo, then Canada, and ended up in Detroit in 1824, looking to buy some land and start a speculating. That's when he met Elisha and Mary Ann Rumsey. Allen purchased the lion's share of the acreage of Ann Arbor, 480 to Rumsey's 160, spending $600 of his shadily borrowed cattle profits. They almost called the town Allensville, but settled on Ann Arbor to honor their wives and the bur oaks that covered the land they'd purchased. Allen was in heaven, pioneering in this new land in the winter months where he'd rebuild his family's fortune. He was content sleeping in a tent behind Elisha's log house because he was always on the move, doing his best to make the new settlement succeed. While the Rumseys played town host, Allen got to use that charm. It took Allen 5 months to work some of that major magic, nudging Michigan Governor Lewis Cass to designate Ann Arbor the county seat, making it the capital city of the new Washtenaw County. That made Allen's sales job a lot easier. Even if in return for being the hottest city in the county, Ann Arbor now had to provide an expensive courthouse, a, quote, substantial bridge over the Huron, and plots of land for public use. The ads he posted in the Detroit Gazette were amazing. Quote, "The subscribers invite the attention of emigrants, particularly of mechanics and artisans, to the village of Ann Arbor." They boasted of a growing town in the heart of a rich and rapidly populating county with lots for sale, quote, "on the most liberal terms to persons desirous of permanently relocating." Conspicuously absent in all of this was Ann Allen. She loved life in the South and, unlike her husband, didn't wish to leave. John finally sent for her in the summer of 1824, and reluctantly she traveled west. She left most of her sons behind, fatherless, knowing they would be ill-equipped for the journey and the destination, and traveled by covered wagon with John Allen's father and some but not all of her children. They left Virginia in August and pulled into Ann Arbor on October 24, 1824. Though they had cramped quarters that winter, John Allen's speculation paid off. The population of Washtenaw County nearly doubled to more than 1,500 by 1825, and Ann Arbor's population rose appreciably. Allen sold plots hand over fist, using the proceeds to buy more and more government land. It wasn't all bur oaks and arbors, though. Allen's co-founder Rumsey died in 1827, then Allen's own father died the following year. He continued to make a small fortune, but as the town grew, Allen adopted more of a founder's role than he intended, sacrificing parcels of land for public use and the greater good. A rich man now, he finally settled his affairs back in Virginia, better safe than sorry, and lived like a beloved prince in Ann Arbor, serving as postmaster, village president, and publishing a local newspaper. He continued taking financial risks, using his personal wealth and borrowing from associates to invest heavily in further land speculation in Michigan. He set up a company right on Wall Street and was ready to become an honest and true financial titan, only to lose it all in a financial crisis called the Panic of 1837. Dejected and broke, he returned to Ann Arbor, where they still welcomed him with open arms, even if he owed a bunch of money to a lot of them. Alan licked his wounds and plotted his next move. He wasn't a young man anymore, had burned through 1, 2, 3 fortunes. He talked about visiting Texas, plotted to explore the unexplored West. It was all too much for Anne, who'd endured John Allen long enough out of sheer love and devotion. She returned to Virginia around 1843, where she lived another 30 years. In her will, she asked that a tombstone be erected, not only to memorialize her, but also her husband, John Allen. The family paid for one grave marker, just for Anne. With Michigan already claimed, John Allen looked west to the gold rush. He set out for California in the winter of 1850, writing 3 lengthy letters to family and friends back in Ann Arbor at various points in his journey. Allen arrived in the San Francisco Territory on April 25, 1850, after a 4-month journey that cost $200. After 3 months, he'd failed to make a strike. After 6, he and his partners had barely paid for the expense of moving to California. They pivoted, buying 20 acres 5 miles outside the city and setting up a farm with vegetables, chickens, and cows. In his final letter home, Allen closed with the ominous line, quote, "My health has not been very good for some days, having a somewhat severe attack of the dysentery now prevailing here." His obituary dated March 11, 1851, described the illness that took him as, quote, "painful and protracted." He was buried in the Yerba Buena Cemetery, then disinterred and buried in Golden Gate Cemetery when they built San Francisco City Hall on the site. The town of Ann Arbor mourned their final fallen founder, but made no attempt to retrieve his remains on the other side of the continent. The true story of John Allen and Elisha Rumsey goes to show you. Out of pretty spectacular crap can spring something truly beautiful. They were dirty, rotten founders, but they were our dirty, rotten founders. Ann Arbor Stories is presented by Rumble Pack Media in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. This episode was written and performed by me, Rich Reddy, with sound and audio engineering by Brian Peters. Thanks once again to the AADL and their archive staff who combed the archives, digitizing old newspaper clippings and photos from Ann Arbor's past. Visit oldnews.aadl.org, put in some search terms, or just click on the photos and see all the amazing work. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Ann Arbor Stories, or email us at annarborstories@gmail.com and let us know how we're doing. Thanks for listening.